This play is very special for anyone who has been involved in it, and particularly because this is a play that has very much come out of a group of Adelaide artists, and particularly I want to acknowledge Brink Productions, who are an independent theatre company based here in Adelaide and producing some great work. But I think this play is testament to the fact that very interesting art comes from small places. Adelaide, in relation to Melbourne and Sydney, is seen slightly out of the main game. So, you know, it's something that we're tremendously proud of, that this work has been born and developed and premiered here, and it's particularly gratifying to be able to bring it back to Adelaide audiences, because with a new work you're never quite sure whether you've got something or not. And the dress rehearsal, I can tell you, we were all quite terrified that we might have misfired on this. Theatre can be like that. It can the last ingredient is the audience, and we didn't have the audience. And when we did on that first preview at the Scott Theatre, they endorsed and affirmed the show in such a way that shocked us all, but also excited us, because we thought, we've got something. And Adelaide audiences continued to support it through the festival. It was the surprise hit of that festival in 2008. And, you know, shone above a lot of the international work. And I think at the City we were very proud of it and excited by it, because, you know, we were flying under the radar. People weren't really expecting it. Our houses were great in that initial season, but it's an enormous risk to bring a show back and only for 1 week. So, we're doing that, but before we launch a tour to Brisbane, Canberra, and our final shows are going to be in Alice Springs, which is particularly moving because the play is partly set in Alice Springs. But it is a risk to bring a play back to a city for 1 week. So I urge you to go and see it if you missed it the first time. Go and see it again if you saw it before, and to please tell your friends. And to support the show, and to support, you know, the local artists. I thought I might begin by actually reading you the opening monologue from the play, which will give you a flavour, a little bit of a flavour of the work. I also should just acknowledge Yalan here, who plays one of the key characters in the play. And if you go to the show, you'll see him do a wonderful performance. I'm not an actor, so you'll have to bear with me. But I'd like to read you this. Let us begin with a steady fall of rain. Gabriel York stands beneath a black umbrella. People pass him by, back and forth, back and forth. Like Gabriel, they carry umbrellas and wear raincoats. Their heads are bent against the relentless weather and against their relentless lives. Back and forth, until in unison they stop. And Gabriel opens his mouth and screams. And a woman falls to her knees in the street. And a fish falls from the sky and lands at Gabriel's feet. Black. Alice Springs, 2039. Gabriel York's room. Gabriel York stands holding the fish. I do not believe in God. I do not believe in miracles. I cannot explain this. It began with a phone call. It was Friday evening, about 10 p.m., which was unusual. The phone rarely rings, and never at that hour. I was reading, as I do before bed, a history, the decline and fall of the American Empire, 1975 to 2015. I am fascinated by the past, which may, at least in part, explain the fish. I have not seen a fish like this for many years, not since I was a boy. I mean, I have seen pictures of them, but not one in the flesh. They are, after all, or at least they are meant to be, extinct. Though I have heard rumours that they are still occasionally caught and served secretly in the most exclusive of restaurants, but only for the select few and only for those who can pay. If I was to purchase such a fish, if purchasing such a fish as this was still possible for a man in the street, it would cost me a year's wages. I could never dream of affording such a delicacy, if such a delicacy still existed, which strangely it seems to do. I hesitated before answering the phone. Wrong number, I thought. Surely, who would call me, at this hour? It was my son, Andrew. The name was his mother's choice. I had wanted to call him Joe, after a man I once knew. He was my stepfather, and he was a good man. He told me he only swore once in his life, and that was the day he met my mother. And he was always losing his hat. He liked to walk, and one day he went for a walk and never came back, so it was probably better that it was Andrew and not Joe. I haven't seen Andrew for many years. I left when he was a boy. It was cowardly of me, I know, but I was not the fathering type. And to be perfectly honest, I thought the boy had a better chance without me. I sent money, of course, when I could, and a card, now and then, for the first few years. I'm not proud of it. Anyway, there he was, this Andrew, this son of mine on the phone at 10 p.m. on a Friday night. Hello, is this Gabriel York? It's Andrew here, your son. I hope you don't mind me calling you like this. I hope you don't mind. It's just that I'm in Alice, and I was wondering if I could see you, Dad. And it went more like, hello, is this Gabriel York? It's Andrew here, your son. I hope you don't mind me calling you like this. I hope you don't mind. It's just that I'm in Alice, and I was wondering if I could see you, Dad. And my mind was racing, trying to stay calm, trying to take each piece of information in. And just as I came to terms with one extraordinary fact, such as it's Andrew, he would say something else, like your son, until I felt unable to reply. And the longer I said nothing, the harder it became to say anything at all. And so I hung up and returned to my book, The Decline and Fall of the American Empire. I can't imagine what he thought of me. I tried to concentrate on the page I was reading, but found myself rereading the same line over and over again, its meaning escaping me. When I tasted something salty in the corner of my mouth and realized I was crying, the tears were falling from my eyes, rolling across my cheeks and gathering in the corners of my mouth, and of course I knew I was crying because of him, hearing his voice, the voice of an adult now when I could only remember the child. But it also felt like I was crying for so much more. So I lifted the receiver and recalled the last number, Andrew, and he didn't say anything, and I knew that he was crying too. And I wondered whether his tears tasted as bitter as mine. I hoped not. I'm so sorry, I said. I'd like to see you very much. Why don't you come for lunch tomorrow? And as soon as I'd given him my address and hung up, I knew it was a mistake. Lunch? What was I thinking? What would I give him? I can hardly feed myself, let alone a son I haven't seen for, 20 years? What do you serve for lunch in circumstances like that? I mean, lunch hardly seems the point. And besides, what will he think of me? Me? I mean, what will he think of the clothes I wear? My suit, which looks all right from a distance, but up close, it's quite shabby and old-fashioned, second-hand or third, perhaps, but certainly not purchased new, and my shoes worn at the toes and down at the heel. And will he notice that I don't wear socks? Not if I don't sit down or cross my legs. If I remain standing, my son won't know that I don't wear socks. And what would he think of my room? It isn't much. It isn't anything at all. A one-room bedsit on the 12th floor. Not the kind of place a father should live, surely. And it needs a paint, and the carpets are worn, and it's dirty. To be perfectly honest, it's filthy. In the corners and on the windowsills and the ceilings, layers of dust and dirt and grime and dead insects, years of neglect. And will he notice the smell of a man who lives alone? I mean, I wash. Of course I wash, but not often. There hasn't been the need until now. And so I began to clean it, the room, that night, a bucket of hot water and soap suds. I washed the walls, the ceilings, even the light fittings were scrubbed. I washed the door handles and the light switches and the dark corners behind the furniture. I scrubbed the table and the floor and polished the windows. I dusted the books and the lampshade and even took to the grouting between the tiles with a toothbrush. And by morning, when I had finally finished, I looked around and it looked exactly the same. So I found an old tin of leftover paint in the cupboard, white or off-white, pure white being too stark, like a hospital. And I pulled the furniture to the centre of the room and covered it with sheets. I took the pictures off the walls. I took the books from the bookcases and I painted and I painted and I painted. And when I finished, I looked around and it still looked exactly the same, only whiter. And I began to feel angry. Why did he call? Why is he doing this? What does he want from me? Money? Is that it? Does he think I'm worth something? Does he think I owe him something? And as I'm thinking these thoughts, I'm also thinking how terrible, how irrational, how baseless, how shameful it was to have these thoughts, how shameful I am, how appalling I am. What kind of man am I? And then I realized it was Saturday. He would be here in an hour and there was nothing to eat. I wanted it to be special. I wanted to feed my son something substantial, something nourishing. Something to make up for all those meals I failed to provide. And there was nothing in the cupboard. So I went out and it was raining, pouring. It has been for days, still is. The river is swollen and threatening to break its banks. Two of the bridges have already been closed. And I didn't know whether I would make the shops or even what I would buy if I got there. And it was too much. I just couldn't manage it. I couldn't look after him then, and I still can't. I just can't. And I screamed. I just screamed. I opened my mouth and screamed, and a fish fell out of the sky and landed at my feet. And it still smelled of the sea. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in miracles. I cannot begin to explain how a fish can fall from the sky in a town surrounded by desert. I cannot begin to explain this, but now all that is left for me to do is to put the fish in the oven and wait for the knock on the door. I know why he is coming, my son. I know what he wants. He wants what all young men want from their fathers. He wants to know who he is, where he comes from, where he belongs. And for the life of me, I don't know what I will tell him. For whilst I know a great deal about the decline and fall of the American Empire, my own past is a mystery. And yet perhaps it will be easier to explain than the fish. Thanks. And for those of you who go and see the play, you'll see that monologue performed beautifully by the actor Neil Pigott. So the play opens in the future, and it opens with a father receiving a phone call from a son he hasn't seen 20 years. It then goes back and tells the story of the past, and ends with a scene where the son, Andrew, who Yalen plays, knocks on the door, and there is a scene of reconciliation between this father and son. But in between those two moments in 2039, we've been in a flat in London during the 1960s. We have been in that flat again in 1988. We have been on the Coorong in 1988 and Ayers Rock in 1988. And we've been in Adelaide in 2013. Have I forgotten anywhice? And Alice Springs at the 2039 at the end and beginning. So this is a play that kind of sweeps through these historical periods and bridges two continents. And in part, it is about the relationship between England and Australia, for it tells a story of a man who was exiled from England and comes to Australia. But a mystery surrounds that. His name is Henry Law, and he leaves London in 1968, and he travels to Australia, and he sends his son seven postcards. His son, Gabriel, doesn't find those postcards for many years later. He has no understanding why his father left, and his mother won't explain it to him. It's a raw subject that can't be discussed. She just remains silent whenever he has asked her. But Gabriel follows his father's footsteps to Australia and uses the 7 postcards to retrace his father's footsteps and hopefully discover, firstly, what happened to him and the reason why he left. That's the sort of basic scenario, except he meets and falls in love with a young Australian girl who runs a truck stop in the Coorong. That's all I'm going to tell you of the story. So you have to come and find out the rest of it. But I'd like to take you back to the beginnings. Chris Drummond is the director of the play and the artistic director of Brink. And he came to me, Kay, what, in 2004? In 2004, and said he would like to begin a collaboration with me and the Adelaide artist Hossein Valamanesh. Chris was interested in sort of bringing different artists from different forms together in order to see what if that could change the process and the kind of way we make theatre. Quentin Grant, the composer, Quincy Grant, the composer, was brought into that early collaboration, as were a number of the ensemble actors from Brink. Chris didn't really know what he wanted the play to be about. What he was particularly interested in is the process, and that's where we began, with process. The project at that point was actually called the Extinction Project, and Chris what Chris was going on in Chris's mind at that time was, if you remember in 2004, it was actually quite a dark time in our recent history, post-9/11. We were still very much trying to make sense of that extraordinary event. It was also a time where our consciousness about climate change was really starting to move from the margins into the centre of our culture. We were trying to talk about it, trying to work out what it actually meant. So this idea of extinction, what if we were on a planet, what if we were destroying the planet? What if we were creating a planet that could no longer sustain us? These were our beginning points. They were vague but rich. We met a number of times, and one of the kind of things that really attracted me to working in this way was its slow development, and also the opportunity to make something in collaboration with others. You know, when as a writer, you're so often isolated and alone and needing to sort of do the whole thing yourself. So the fact that I had these other kind of wonderful minds to explore a subject was very attractive. But the other interesting thing for me was I hadn't written a play for some time. I'd been caught up in the film world and working in Hollywood, and that's a crazy thing, working in Hollywood, for a whole lot of reasons. And then Chris offered me this opportunity to find my way back to theatre. The last play I'd done was a play that had also premiered in Adelaide at the State Theatre Company called Holy Day, directed by Rosalba Clemente. I think that had been in 2000, from memory. So it was about 5 years since I'd written a play. I was tentative about coming back to the form. I wasn't quite sure if I'd got theatre anymore. So it was an opportunity for me to sort of rediscover the medium and rediscover the audience. It was a slow burn process. We got together every now and then. We discussed the ideas. They edged forward. And my strongest memory of that time is how trusting we were of one another. We believed that the ideas would come, and there was no pressure put on me by Chris to kind of deliver a definitive text that early. At some point, though, maybe 2005, 2006, I travelled to Paris with my family. I knew what we had come out up with was that we were all feeling very uncertain about the future. And there was a sort of... And I had children, and Chris had children, and we were wondering what kind of world we were going to pass on. This question of the legacy came up quite early in the development of the work. What is it that... What do we pass on to our children, and what do we inherit from our parents? That was a matter of great concern to us, this notion of that we could be handing on a world that was in worse shape than the world we inherited. We bore that responsibility quite heavily. So you could say we were depressed about the future. And then it's very hard to be depressed in Paris. It's a beautiful city, and it reminds you of everything that's wonderful in life. And I happened to see an exhibition whilst I was in Paris, and it was, can't quite remember the full title, but it was called Genius and Madness in Art. And for those of you who are familiar with Paris and visual arts, they are amazing curators. They can curate an exhibition that conveys meaning in ways that I haven't really encountered before. So this exhibition was about melancholy. The title was Melancholy, Madness and Genius in Art. So it was a whole exhibition just about melancholy or melancholia. Arts from prehistory through to the very contemporary. We were racing home late one evening. It was getting dark. The kids were tired and whingy, and everyone was hungry. But we walked past this exhibition, and for some reason, my wife Eugenia said, "We've got to have a look at this." I said, "It's closing. It's not." No, I'm too tired. Let's go home. I'm hungry. Let's go to a restaurant. No, we have to go to this exhibition. So we went in there and we had about half an hour. And it was an astonishingly beautiful collection of works. And what I realized, or the kind of epiphany I guess I had, was that melancholia is not about sadness. Melancholia is a... can be defined as a deep reflection, and the deep reflection that we need to do before we are able to change. And when I thought about that, I thought that is such a wonderful way to think about our own age. So rather than to think about that this is a depressing and dark time, that we are destroying the planet, that we are... We can't change that. The damage has been done in the past. Therefore, I feel powerless. What that exhibition taught me was that we as a culture, as a society, are actually doing the deep thinking required in order to bring about change. Now, that for me was a significant shift in the way I was thinking about this play. Suddenly, I moved from being powerless to feeling empowered. And I sent Chris an email from Paris describing that moment. And he now kind of talks about that moment as being a breakthrough for him and his understanding in this work. One of the paintings I saw at this exhibition was Goya's Saturn Devours His Children. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but it is incredibly graphic image of this kind of monstrous father figure literally having bitten his son in half with blood pouring everywhere. It's horrific. But it struck me, and again, kind of immediately struck a chord with the kind of work that we're trying to do, that we were trying to do on the play. The underlying question of the play was the relationship between the past and the present and the future. And that painting seemed to me to speak very clearly about what we were doing to our future. We were literally eating our children. It gave me a very kind of powerful image. Again, I wrote to Chris and described it to him. He looked it up on the net, and this image of Saturn devouring his children sort of became a bit of a talisman and a guide for us. But it also unlocked for what had been a very kind of abstract collection of ideas about climate change, about the future, and suddenly I thought, I'm writing a play about a father and son. I'm writing, and it kind of shifted the notion of the play from the abstract to the to a story about family, about people. And ultimately, I mean, in the theatre, that's what we're writing about. We have to find a way to take really big and abstract concepts and contain them within the story of human relationship. And once I knew I was writing about a family, I kind of was away. I knew what I had to do. At some point, maybe late 2006 or 2007, we did a sustained workshop, 3 weeks, I think, with all the collaborators now involved. Hossein, Quincy, myself, Chris, design elements, and the actors, including many of the actors who went on to actually be in the play. We had 2 weeks. Again, we started with no text, but we started with a lot of images, and we started with improvisation, building the work through various improvisations. And again, you know, the first week was very woolly. We didn't know where we were going. We didn't know what we were trying to build. And halfway through the second week, things started to fall into place. And it was about, the epiphany for me was about family relationship and how time would work in the play. And for those of you who are going to go and see the play, the first 20 minutes of it or so are quite confusing because we're not quite sure who's who or where they belong. But there are moments in the play where it all connects and you've got to trust it because when it delivers, when it pays off, it's very satisfying. Because as an audience, you've made that in previous investment of going, of really having to work and follow and listen. And when it kind of lands, it lands in a kind of very profound way, it seems to be for the audience. But that, so the breakthrough in that workshop was to work out how time worked. And the beautiful thing about theatre that you can't do in film and you can't do in television is that you can layer time, you can treat time simultaneously. So suddenly I was able to kind of write a moment in 1988 and a moment in 1959 and juxtapose them together on stage. Now that might sound simple, but actually working out how that's going to happen took a lot of work. We also worked with this idea called superimposition, which was so putting one time frame on another, on another, on another. Now, sometimes when I go to a play and it opens, the lights come up and we are in a particular place, if we're still in that place by the end of the play, I feel a bit restless or I feel a bit shortchanged. I mean, we're a very sophisticated audience now. I don't want to be in the same room that I was when I began the play, or I don't want to be in the same emotional place. In other words, I want the play to take me somewhere, literally and emotionally. I think so much kind of modern theatre replicates television. And you know, I think one of the reasons I'm very proud of this work is that I think it pushes the medium of theatre. It still tells a complex and rich story. So it pushes the form, but doesn't obscure the content. It still delivers a satisfying story. which as a storyteller and a dramatist is very important to me. That's a very kind of, and Rabina, wave to me when I'm going over time. I'm going to speak for about 30, 40 minutes, then we're going to have some questions. Where are you, Rabina? Oh, you put your hand up when I'm getting too late? Okay. So that's a kind of broad outline of our process, and then we came together in a more traditional... Well, I actually have to go and write it. I forgot about that bit. after the workshop, and you know, Kay Jamison, the executive producer at Brink, can testify that I pushed everybody's limits of patience, because it was hard to write. It was incredibly hard. And I also had a horrific deadline on a film that sort of landed at the same time. So I was frantically trying to finish the play. I mean, these guys had to rehearse it and put it on in the festival. We had an end point. And it wasn't coming. It wasn't coming. October, November, December. And they really, really needed it. The show had to be designed. Hossein had to kind of design the show. And I would write, and send Chris what I'd written that day. And to his credit, he never lost it with me. He continually endorsed what I was doing. And I think if he had come back and said, this isn't working or this isn't good, I would have collapsed in a heap and said, well, you write the fucking thing. But he had enormous patience, and it was the right call. It's what I needed. And I think he was also quite excited by what he was getting. And even though it was only in pieces, I mean, I guess Kay and Chris were reading it and going, well, how's it all going to work and how's it going to fit? But we got there somehow. And that's the thrill of when you have a deadline. And I usually need a deadline actually to get something finished. It's not a quality I'm particularly proud of. But I did get it finished. We took it into rehearsal. It was cast. Chris cast it beautifully with a great ensemble of actors. Then, you know, like all good rehearsals, it goes into a period of you lose sight of what it is that you're trying to make. And that peaked for us on our dress rehearsal. And I remember Chris's, the colour draining from Chris's face, and Hossein, who hadn't done theatre since he was a young man in Iran, kind of going, ooh, what have we got? And I remember walking up Frome Street, and I phoned Eugenia, my wife, and said, I think this isn't going to work. And she said, it'll be fine. She's an actor, and she knows that it'll be fine. And of course it was, because when that I was sitting in that preview audience, and at some point in that monologue that I read to you, the audience laughed. And I saw the cast, I saw Neil and the cast, when they came on, lift. And it's such an exciting moment in the theatre when you see your actors suddenly go, we've got a story to tell. And to have confidence in the material. So it was truly a wonderful night, that first preview. I've left out so many details about the show's development. But it was a long time ago, and it's hard to remember them all. But what was it kind of so wonderful about this show was that I think it went beyond all our expectations. Firstly, it had a wonderful season here in the Adelaide Festival. The Adelaide Festival is only 2 weeks. So, you know, I'm not sure how 10,000 people saw that show. That's a high number, isn't it? That's great numbers for Adelaide. We were very proud of that show. We were very proud that then Cate Blanchett and Andrew Upton took the show to Sydney at the Sydney Theatre Company. We were able to keep our entire cast together. That's not easy. And again, I think it's testament to the production and the play that all those actors wanted to stay with it and didn't suddenly have other jobs or other things that they wanted to do. Sydney was a wonderful season. By all reports, I actually wasn't here I caught the end of the season. Sydney audiences absolutely embraced it. It was one of the biggest box office earners for the Sydney Theatre Company in that year. And of course, the opportunity to do it again meant we could consolidate the work. I'd done rewrites. The actors had an opportunity to go further and deeper with their performances. But simultaneously, at this point, the work was being rehearsed at the Almeida Theatre in London, and directed by Michael Attenborough. I said to before, I'll tell you a little story about Michael. He actually came out to Australia to see me. He'd read the play and fallen in love with it, and he was going to do anything he could to do it. So he came all the way out here, and as I said, the play is partly set in the Coorong. The other thing I wanted to just mention before I tell the story about Michael, I'm not an Adelaide-born or South Australian-born person, and I always thought that we would come here for a few years and I would go back to Melbourne. We would go back to Melbourne. But this play, for me, was a way of kind of acknowledging that, no, I'm here, and I'm here for a longer time than I ever thought I was. And it was a way for me to connect into the landscape, particularly the Coorong. So I started to visit the Coorong a lot. And I'm not sure, don't know about you, but I'm very affected by estuarine landscapes. They're very kind of uncertain, tenuous places. They don't quite belong to the ocean, and they don't quite belong to the land. So they're these in-between places. It's a beautiful place for obvious reasons, but it's also a slightly uncertain place, if that makes sense. It's tenuous. And there is a reason why the two of the important locations in the play are this kind of half land, half water landscape where the effects of climate change are felt so acutely. You know, places like the Coorong are a bit like the canary in the coal mine. They go first. And I just caught on the news before I came down that the Murray River's just broken through to the sea for the first time in years. But I'm kind of very interested in that kind of landscape. So it's set there, and it's also set in at Ayers Rock, at the very kind of centre of the country, on very solid ground. And those two kind of landscapes give you a sense of the emotional journey that these characters go on. But Mike came out, and he's a charming... he's Richard's son and David's nephew, a charming Englishman, quite eccentric as Englishmen can be. And one of my kids, Manny, speaks with quite a broad accent, having been brought up in a country town. And Mike speaks with a very refined English accent. And he could not understand Manny, and Manny couldn't understand him. They were the funniest two to watch have a conversation. But I took him down to the Coorong, and he was fascinated by the landscape and what it meant to me. Mike was very enthusiastic about the play and very determined that it would be produced in London. But the upshot of that was that I had a production going on in London at the same time that we were opening in Sydney. And it was hard not to be here with the Australian production at that time. But very exciting to be in London. The play was later done... The play was later done at the Melbourne Theatre Company later that year, and then in New York at the Lincoln Centre earlier this year. It's going to be done... It was also done in New Zealand, a very fine production. I didn't get to see it. And it will be done in Germany, which is its first foreign language production.